Disaster at our doorstep today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Hurricane Florence is charging for the Carolinas. Hopefully not a disaster for residents there, but it is going to be a big one. And we better get used to bigger, stronger storms because that's part of our new climate reality.
It's not that climate change is making storms more frequent. It is likely that it's going to make them more powerful and damaging.
We'll hear from the Global Climate Summit in California. The environment minister from Somaliland is there. She says climate change has been devastating for many people back home, but she's not giving up.
We really look into the eyes of these people. We are their hope. I have to have hope because they have hope in us.
Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Thanks for being with us today. And if you're joining us from the southeast Atlantic coast, we're thinking of you as you do your best to get out of the way of Hurricane Florence. Evacuate if you've been told to, and if you can. If not, follow the advice of your local emergency response officials. Florence is forecast to slam into the Carolinas late tomorrow or early Friday. It's shaping up to be a serious storm with up to 3 feet of rain in some parts of the Carolinas and heavy rains expected all the way from Georgia to Virginia, not to mention the flooding from possible storm surges. Florence is the latest in a series of massive storms that have threatened large areas of the U.S. in the last few years, and the latest in a string of extreme weather events around the world this summer. All of them were revved up to one degree or another by our changing global climate. That warming climate and the urgent need to take stronger action to address the growing climate crisis, it's the focus of a big meeting this week in San Francisco called the Global Climate Action Summit. It was organized by California Governor Jerry Brown. The World's Carolyn Beeler is in San Francisco covering the event, so I gather the seeds for this meeting were sown back in June of 2017, last year, when President Trump pulled the U.S. out of the Paris Agreement.
That's right. Almost immediately after President Trump stood in the Rose Garden announcing he'd pull the U.S. out of the Paris Agreement, state and local and business leaders formed this coalition called We're Still In, saying that even if the federal government was not going to be meeting its commitments to cut carbon, they would. And then shortly after that, Governor Jerry Brown announced that he'd be convening this high-level summit in California. And it's the highest profile move he's made in staging his own rogue foreign policy and picking up the mantle of climate leadership that the U.S. federal government has dropped. And it's important to note that California is the fifth largest economy in the world. So even though it's not a nation itself, it has a lot of clout in this area.
Yeah, but just to be clear, this is not an official meeting of any kind, right? It's not part of the UN process or any other formal international body.
It's not. It's a standalone independent summit organized by Brown and other leaders, including China's head climate negotiator. And it should be noted that this event comes at a time when action through that official UN has stalled a bit. Not as much progress was made as was hoped at a big meeting in Bangkok just last week. And current country commitments are still well short of the stated goal of the Paris Agreement to limit global warming to well under 2 degrees Celsius. So a lot of people are staking a good amount of hope in what are being called subnational actors, so cities and states and businesses.
So what do the organizers of the Global Action Climate Summit hope will come out of this? How are they going to measure success?
Well, the top-level goal is to start curving emissions down by 2020, which is, you know, just a year and a half away. It seems like a very ambitious goal. How leaders hope to get there is by peer pressure and getting states and cities and businesses to announce new commitments to cutting carbon here this week. Governor Jerry Brown tried to set the stage for that by making some big announcements about commitments to green energy earlier this week. And there will be more announcements coming out from the state of Virginia and private companies today. But I think whether or not this will be a success is something that's going to be a little hard to measure and might take some time to see what the end results are.
I'm sure the state of Virginia has a lot of other things on its mind, and I want to get back to Hurricane Florence here just for a minute. Last year, the U.S. was hit by two massive and incredibly destructive hurricanes, Harvey in Texas and Louisiana, and Maria in Puerto Rico and Florida. Now here we are a year later. We've got Florence. We don't know, of course, how it's going to play out over the next few days. But what do we know about the connection between these super powerful storms and climate change?
What we do know is that hurricanes are expected to grow more powerful and extreme going forward. There's a growing understanding that climate change is sort of making storms that start out small more likely to grow more powerful. And it looks like this upcoming storm, just like Harvey did a year ago, is likely to stall over land and dump a lot of rain all at once. So it's not that climate change is making storms more frequent. It is likely that it's going to make them more powerful and damaging.
The World's Carolyn Beeler in San Francisco. And if you would, Carolyn, just stick around with us here for a bit. Our partners at station KQED in San Francisco are also in the thick of covering this conference and the climate challenge this week. We asked their science editor, Craig Miller, to take a look at where we are with the climate crisis, how we got here, and where we might be going. Here's his report.
You can kind of think of global warming like tossing a bag of popcorn into the microwave. Anthropogenic, or human-caused, warming has been stoked since the start of the Industrial Age more than 200 years ago. But that first 100 or so years was kind of like the first minute in the microwave. It wasn't obvious that much was happening. But then, you get to that second minute. And you can think of all those individual pops as events: superstorms, extreme downpours, high tide flooding, droughts, melting glaciers, ferocious wildfires. They're like the signals that the climate is changing. And in popcorn terms,
we are in that second minute.
Inez Fung is an atmospheric scientist at UC Berkeley. I spoke with her at the edge of the Berkeley campus, surrounded by greenhouse gas emissions from traffic, construction, and by the generation that will inherit the problem, a problem we can already see unfolding around us.
30 years ago, we predicted it in the models, and now I'm experiencing it. You see the fires in western U.S., in British Columbia, and then at the same time we've got fires, it rained 3 feet in Hilo, Hawaii, from the hurricane. That is a new record. At the same time that we have droughts and fires, over 300 people died in India from floods. We are not prepared.
Across the U.S., the average temperature has risen almost 2 degrees Fahrenheit since the start of the 20th century. Bill Collins directs climate and ecological science at Lawrence Berkeley National Lab.
So we released enough carbon dioxide to continue warming the climate for several centuries to come.
That means a certain amount is already baked in, if you will. In other words, going back to our popcorn, even if you hit the stop button on the oven, some of those kernels will keep popping.
If we were to stop emissions entirely of all greenhouse gases right this minute, we'd see roughly another half a degree centigrade by the end of the 21st century.
That's almost a full degree Fahrenheit already in the pipeline. So even if we shut down all emissions, which is not happening, we might still get to the threshold where scientists say the worst effects of climate change would kick in.
We're seeing years now that basically blow the roof off of records back to the late 19th century. None of the students in my classes have grown up in a normal climate.
Think about that. On the flip side, if you're over, say, 30 years old and can actually recall normal, that's over.
I have to say that all the projections that we made 30 years ago are still valid.
Inez Fung.
The only thing we had not anticipated, and you can put it in any way, is that the CO2 increase is much faster than we ever thought.
Despite the pledges made in Paris by every nation in the world, except this one, emissions are still rising. And even those historic commitments, if they're all kept, won't be sufficient to turn things around.
No, we're already beyond that. The commitments, I think, are a very good start, but they're just not adequate.
First thing we have to do is, as a global community, reverse course rather sharply. We think it is technically feasible.
Technically feasible, perhaps, but not easy. California, for instance, has the nation's most aggressive efforts to cut greenhouse gases. Overall, it's working. Total emissions are down 13% since 2004. And still, climate emissions from cars and trucks have been on the rise.
Cars literally are time machines.
Remember the movie Back to the Future?
First, you turn the time circuits on.
Doc Brown's time machine was a car, a slightly modified DeLorean, and perhaps in anticipation of future needs, electric.
This is what makes time travel possible.
Most of our cars still run on fossil fuels, which make for another kind of time travel. But Bill Collins says they're not taking us to the future.
They're taking the atmosphere back to a chemical state that it has not been in for millions of years. Currently, we have as much carbon dioxide in the Earth's atmosphere as we had 5 million years ago.
The world 5 million years ago was not our world. There were early ancestors of humans and the first tree sloths, but mammoths had yet to appear.
So our steam engines, our factories, our cars, in the space of, you know, a little over 230 years, they've taken us back 5 million years.
And Collins says we have about 25 years, or one generation, to reverse course. He and Fung both have their glimmers of optimism that technology and the boom in wind, solar, and other clean energy could quickly reduce climate emissions. Fung points to the young college students passing by us on campus as her best hope.
I'm very optimistic about the young people because they're very proactive about the future.
But Fung and Collins agree that time is what's running out.
Reporter Craig Miller there in San Francisco. Carolyn Beeler, also in San Francisco, is back with us. What is the mood there at the climate summit about how big a hole we're in and how big a challenge it is for us to dig ourselves out?
I've heard Governor Jerry Brown describe where we are right now as the base of Mount Everest. So it's widely acknowledged that we have a huge task ahead of us. A lot of people here express a lot of optimism, saying there are a lot of people working towards solutions on this. But it's a little hard to tell if that is optimism born out of necessity or if it's true that folks really think we will be able to prevent the worst impacts of climate change from hitting us.
Carolyn, you've also been speaking with some of the people who've come to San Francisco this week from all over the world to push for stronger action on the climate crisis, and we've been hearing their voices. Who do you have for us today?
So today we're going to hear from Shukra Haj Ismail. She has an interesting story to tell. She is the Minister of Environment for Somaliland, which is an autonomous region within the nation of Somalia that's been devastated by droughts that have driven internal displacement for the past several years.
All right, the world's Carolyn Beeler in San Francisco, thank you very much. And here's Shukra Haj Ismail.
And I'm the Minister of Environment and Rural Development for Somaliland. Climate change have impacted Somaliland so bad that you wouldn't believe it. We have experienced 9 episodes of droughts from 1996 until 2017. It impacted the livelihoods of millions of people. Thousands and thousands of livestock died, 80% of Somaliland livestock. You can imagine a country losing 80% of its assets. So many people became destitute, so many people became displaced, so many people migrated from rural areas into the urban areas. More than 10 camps are now in the capital. It is not an issue that we can say it will be solved today or tomorrow, no. But we have also to think about the long way. I believe that the international community will come together. They are coming together now. And I believe that there are so many active people who are really aware of what is going around. So I'm very optimistic that the international community will do something about it. Long-term programs, resilience programs in development should be there, because so many people are displaced. When you really look into the eyes of these people, we are their hope. I have to have hope because they have hope in us.
Shukra Haj Ismail of Somaliland there, speaking with the world's Carolyn Beeler at this week's Global Climate Summit in San Francisco. Check out more first-person climate change stories in our Instagram feed. That's at PRI The World. And you are tuned to The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We've got Russian spies on our mind for the next few minutes. Alleged Russian spies, real ones, ex-spies, and even the fictional variety. Let's start with the latest twist in the case of Sergei Skripal. You'll recall the former Russian double agent and his daughter were the targets of an attempted poisoning in the UK. British officials last week named two suspects, both alleged Russian spies. Today, Russian President Vladimir Putin said the Kremlin had found the two men and that there's nothing criminal about them.
Мы, конечно, посмотрели, что это за люди.
That's Putin speaking at an event in Vladivostok today. He was also asked whether the suspects are civilians. Of course they are, says Putin. He seems pretty certain about that. Then again, the Brits are also pretty sure the men involved are members of the GRU, Russian Military Intelligence, which reminds me of this.
Who told you I was an agent?
So you deny being a secret agent?
As I said before, numerous of times. I will never deny and I will never confirm the fact.
That's Anna Chapman, the Russian sleeper agent who was arrested by the FBI in 2010. And despite what she said in that clip, she pleaded guilty to conspiring to work as an unregistered Russian agent in the U.S. She ended up being deported back to Russia as part of a spy swap that involved, guess who? Sergei Skripal. Anyway, that swap spared Chapman from spending serious time in an American jail. That is still a possibility, though, for Maria Butina. Remember her?
I am a chairman of the Right to Bear Arms. It's a Russian non-profit organization that protects civil rights to keep and bear arms.
Quick recap here. Butina was arrested this summer and accused of the same thing Anna Chapman was accused of, working undercover as a Russian agent here in the U.S. In Butina's case, it was also alleged that she tried to use sex as part of her deception. Prosecutors have since taken that back, admitting they misread texts she sent to a friend as a joke. But Butina remains in jail pending a trial. Sam Green is following her case closely. He's with the Russia Institute at King's College in London. So, Sam, just remind us who Butina is and what the charges are against her.
Well, I mean, to be honest, we don't exactly know who she is, right? She came to the United States as a graduate student with ties in political circles close to the Kremlin. In Russia, she presents herself as an activist on behalf of gun rights organizations in Russia, although there is not really a high-profile gun rights movement in the country, and the government certainly doesn't support that. She has built up relationships on that basis, though, with the NRA and the Republican Party, and she faces charges of having acted on behalf of a foreign government, of seeking influence in ways that are not strictly legal in the United States.
What is your reaction to these prosecutors admitting they were wrong on parts of their accusations of Butina?
I think that it speaks to a broader issue, which is quite apart from any guilt that Ms. Butina may have. Almost anything being done these days by a Russian in and around the quarters of power, even sometimes just in the city of Washington or London, all of a sudden looks suspicious in ways that wouldn't be true if this was somebody from another country.
Does this mean, though, that Butina is innocent and not a Russian agent? I mean, she's still behind bars and there are other charges.
Not at all. I mean, clearly there are very serious charges against her. And, you know, we trust due process to sort that out. The prosecutors will make their case. And the reality is that the charges are quite plausible. The Russian government has, through various intermediaries, sought influence of various kinds with right-wing groups around the world, including in the United States, but also here in the UK, in France and Germany and Austria and various other places. But I think there seems to have been an effort to bind this up, even stoke the public imagination, along plot lines that probably have a little bit more to do with Hollywood than with reality.
All right, so let's talk about how Butina is seen in the U.S. media and more widely perceived in America. I mean, there was her high-profile arrest in July, lots of lascivious innuendo, and now we're getting information that some of those accusations against her are not true. What does this say about the way U.S. media covers Russian figures?
Over the last 20 years or so, really up until Crimea in 2014.
The Russian annexation of Crimea and eastern Ukraine, yeah.
Exactly. I mean, most of the American media, most of the American public was not paying much attention to Russia at all, right? And so when we have all of a sudden turned our attention back to Russia in a very serious way, in truth, for very serious reasons, we don't always have a lot of background and information to go on. We don't always have a lot of memory and understanding of what's going on in Russia and how Russia has changed in the post-Soviet period. And so we fall back on, in some cases, stereotypes. We fall back in some cases on memories of what things were like in the Cold War. And when all of a sudden we have something that looks like a honey trap, you know, something out of a movie like Red Sparrows or whatever it was, that is maybe too tempting for some people to avoid.
Why do you think the U.S. media and even some lawyers won't move beyond the Russian honeypot trope?
I think because it is, not to put too fine a point on it, it's sexy. It provokes a response. It sends a clear message out to audiences, potentially to juries as well. It seems to be much more clear-cut and much more clearly nefarious, right, than, you know, maybe the more blurred lines around seeking access and influence through more traditional means.
Sam Green, the director of the Russia Institute at King's College in London, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
It's not just the news media that likes a good Russian villain trope. Hollywood does too, of course. Kristen Hunt is a writer in New York City who studied the way Russian villains have been portrayed on American screens.
You don't see the villain type until after World War II, because there was actually a brief moment in World War II where the U.S. actually had to go the opposite way and hype Russians as an ally. And so you actually see a lot of problematic propaganda around that time where Joseph Stalin is kind of softened in a lot of movies, and these movies were later brought up in the House of Un-American Activities Committee hearings. But then after that ends, sort of starting after, I guess you could put it around the Iron Curtain speech, you start to slowly see emerge this type. A lot of people point to the Boris and Natasha cartoon as an early example. Yeah. It's pretty familiar, I would say, by the 50s and 60s, but it really, the stereotypical idea we have of this Russian villain type, I think, truly emerges in the 80s, kind of the Reagan era, where you see Red Dawn and you see Rocky IV, Ivan Drago's a very, you know, easy catch-all for this type.
You will lose.
So what are some of the conventions used for a Russian villain? Like, what are they like physically and verbally?
Most people know the Ivan Drago type. You know, they're very strong, they're very stoic, and there's kind of an eerie calm to them. Once the USSR dissolved, that kind of brawny, beefy guy didn't make as much sense because you don't have this monolith USSR type to really stand in as the villain. And so you start to see more of these shadowy underground types, Russian gangsters who are kind of splintering off in the aftermath. In The Equalizer, Denzel Washington is fighting these Russian gangsters who are running a sex trafficking ring. In Limitless, it's the drug dealer who gives Bradley Cooper these mind-altering drugs is a Russian. In John Wick, the men who just kill his dog and set off this rampage are also Russians. But they're kind of, again, these less brawny and less obvious. They're more underground, shadowy criminals.
With the Robert Mueller Russia investigations, you see a Russian villain making a comeback.
You know, I'm interested to see what happens in the next couple of years, because I think that if we are seeing a comeback, it'll probably be in a few years.
Writer Kristen Hunt speaking with us from New York City about the Russian villain. Thanks very much.
All right. Thank you.
You're with the world. I'm Marco Werman. Coming up on The World, we continue our week-long focus on how women live in today's Afghanistan. We're going to hear from a fashion designer working to give Afghan women more choices when it comes to what they wear.
It's the first thing people see in you, and it can be a way of Afghans expressing themselves and who they are.
That's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. The news we hear from Afghanistan on any given day is not good news. War, bombings, terror attacks, and way too often, civilians caught in the middle. But that's one side of the reality on the ground in Afghanistan. The World's Shirin Jafari is in the studio with me now to talk about how this is a part of what's going on, but that there's also a rich and deep cultural life in Afghanistan as well.
Yeah, Marco, there's so much more to the country than just an endless cycle of violence. Culture, art, music, and fashion, these things are alive and flourishing in Afghanistan.
And we've been hearing a lot of this in your stories this week on the show, and it's also part of your story today.
Before I talk about today's story, I need to give you a bit of background. Stay with me here, Marco.
Okay.
Let's go back to August last year to a meeting between President Trump and a team of his military advisors. They were there to decide whether to send more U.S. troops to Afghanistan. Now, before Trump became president, what he said on the campaign trail was that he didn't want to send in more troops, that he just wanted to focus on our own country.
Right. America first.
Right. But on that day in August and in that meeting, Trump changed his mind.
What happened in the meeting?
I wasn't in the room, of course, but according to the Washington Post, General H.R. McMaster, Trump's national security advisor at the time, pulled out a photo of Afghanistan from the 1970s. It showed Afghan women in miniskirts walking down a street in Kabul.
So this is the 1970s, before the Taliban, before the image of blue burqas, women dressed like they did here in the West.
McMaster's argument was this. Look, Afghanistan had adopted Western values in the past, and this could be Afghanistan again if we send in more troops. After that meeting, President Trump agreed to send an additional 4,000 troops.
So Trump made the decision to send troops based on a photo of women in miniskirts in Kabul?
Well, he may have taken this into consideration, but all this got me interested in looking at how women in Afghanistan are thinking about fashion today. So when I was in Kabul, I went to meet with an up-and-coming fashion designer.
And I'm really looking forward to this story. Let's hear it.
It's a tense morning in Kabul. There are more checkpoints than usual, police everywhere, fewer people in the streets. That's because yesterday there was a suicide attack, another one. This city has become a battlefield between U.S. and Afghan government forces and the Taliban plus the Islamic State. But that all seems a world away when I enter the Laman boutique. Here, on the second floor of a nondescript building, a photo shoot is in full swing.
Also, eye contact or just...
Two models, a young man and a woman, sit under bright lights facing each other. The wall behind them is covered with a colorful fabric. The models look longingly but awkwardly into each other's eyes, trying hard to forget the strict social norms that forbid them from doing this. But it doesn't last. This is a photo shoot for the Laman label, a Kabul-based fashion house. It's the dream of Rahiba Rahimi. Over freshly brewed tea and soft sponge cake, Rahimi tells me why she thought war-torn Afghanistan needs fashion.
It's the first thing people see in you, and it can be a way of Afghans expressing themselves and who they are.
Rahimi says before she started Laman, she always thought that the only way to change Afghanistan was to change its politics.
There was a time in my life where I was very political, so...
But then she realized change can start with what you wear.
I always kind of knew I'll have a boutique somehow.
The idea behind Laman is simple. Take colorful traditional Afghan designs that already exist and turn them into practical, edgy streetwear.
Afghan women have always enjoyed colors and different patterns and dresses. So it's built in the culture and it's there. So this dress, the whole design is the waist part, which is this...
Rahimi picks out a long cream dress from one of the racks. There are intricate burgundy flowers embroidered on its waist. Think Anthropology, maybe Urban Outfitters. But handmade in Afghanistan.
That is very traditional, but this is done in a very, like, kind of modernish dress. This one would be around 3,000 Afs, $40 or so.
That might sound like a steal, but that's how much most Afghans earn in a month. Most of Rahimi's customers are inside the country, and she knows her designs are too expensive for a lot of women here.
Like a top, like a really fancy dress kind of top.
But she employs local women to do the embroidery. The woman can work from home, which she says is crucial since some conservative families don't allow women to work outside the home.
And these are more kind of like the new embroideries for spring that is light, that is wearable.
Rahimi thinks Laman has shaken up the fashion scene here.
The first time we had a red carpet and we had models with funky makeup and crazy clothes that people weren't used to. A lot of people stood up and kind of criticized. I was really scared because I was like, I don't know what's going to happen, you know, because this can be threatening.
It can be threatening because of the Taliban. In the 1990s, the Taliban forced women to wear burqas in public. Women were punished if they were caught not wearing one. Today, the Taliban's no longer in power, but people still live in fear of their attacks. I asked Rahimi if she worries about security.
It is a concern for everyone. for example, if something happens here, you are the one who's in charge and everything. If there is some security threat, we try to tell everyone not to come that day if we're aware of it.
It's not easy to be a fashion designer in a war zone and in a country where often women struggle for their basic rights. Rahimi, though, thinks that Afghanistan is ready for young, ambitious women like her.
You see, even those traditional mindsets are kind of transforming into more acceptance. So I think in near future, we'll see more change.
Designing, making, and selling clothes, it might sound like a simple mission, but not in Kabul. Rahimi walks me out of her boutique. I say goodbye to her and the armed guard who stands at the door. He closes the heavy metal gates behind me. For the world, Shirin Jafari, Kabul, Afghanistan.
If you want to see some of those fashions from Afghanistan, we've got photos of what 2018 streetwear looks like there. They're up now on our Across Women's Lives Instagram. Just search for at Women's Lives. And coming up tomorrow, Afghanistan's growing plastic surgery industry. Wars create scars, emotional ones and physical ones. And for years in Afghanistan, the physical ones were the ones plastic surgeons fixed. Now one surgeon in Kabul is changing women's faces to, get this, change their ethnicity.
We have done for her plastic surgery, and we removed here some fat and also some skin. Now she is better.
That story is coming up tomorrow as we continue to tell the untold stories of Afghan women. In the West African nation of Togo, one family has held power since 1967. That's when a young colonel, Nasingbe Eyadema, launched a coup and installed himself as president. He ruled with an iron fist for 38 years, and when he died in 2005, his son, Faure Nasingbe, took over, continuing the brutal family regime. Activists in Togo have tried to organize and oust the regime. One of those still trying is 28-year-old Farida Naburema. She remembers growing up under the rule of Nasingbe Eyadema, and she says he demanded nothing short of worship from his people.
People in Togo had to dance and chant his name every single day, every morning when he's going to work from his palace to his office. People have to line up to clap for him when he's going home as well. At the same time, he lived a very luxurious and lavish life. Unfortunately, even though Eyadema's style of ruling has changed a little bit, because we don't see Togolese people dancing and chanting for him today, we don't do it for his son. The repression is still the same when it comes to democracy, because activists are being arrested and tortured. Togo is on the list of one of the worst countries to be in terms of human rights.
Yeah. I was a Peace Corps volunteer in Togo in the mid-80s when General Eyadema was in charge. I was a school teacher, and we had to join those ceremonies paying homage to the president. Even, you know, if us non-Togolese didn't show up, it was noticed. Eyadema arrested your father when you were a young girl, so this is pretty personal. What do you remember about that?
He arrested my father on many occasions, but the one that remained vivid was when I was 13 years old. That was in 2003. It was the very first time that I saw my dad being handcuffed to the military truck. The soldiers came to our house and they searched our rooms. They destroyed everything. That's when I actually gained awareness about the dictatorship we were living in. Later, when my dad was released, I started asking questions, and he started educating me about his struggle. And it was not just him. My grandfather as well was arrested by the regime because he was also against this dictatorship. At a very early age, I started writing against the regime, attending protests and meetings, political meetings with my dad. And I joined his party back in the days when I was 15 years old. I got my party membership card.
You were still a teenager. That must have been a pretty dangerous decision for a young person to make.
Well, at the time, I was not really conscious about the risks and the danger of it. But
are you saying that you were too young to be scared?
Actually, it was not too young to be scared. I think I have went through the worst fear out of listening to some of the most horrible stories that my father told me about his experience in prison and that of his comrades. And coming from that perspective, when I founded the movement and people were telling me things like, Farida, do you know what you're doing is dangerous? Farida, do you know you can get us killed? These were critics from my family. My perspective was like, I got angrier because I was aware of the extent to which the regime could go in terms of abusing citizens in that country.
As an activist, a key part of your strategy has been using social media to organize. A few years ago, you started challenging members of parliament in Togo who opposed term limits, and you published all their personal numbers and contacts online. Then you called the MPs on the phone and recorded the conversations. What happened next?
Every resource that we have to fight this government, we must use, and every nonviolent resource we have. We cannot afford to fight them violently because we will fail. So nonviolence is a strategic decision for us. We must be nonviolent. When they shoot their guns, they hit one person at a time with a bullet. But when we use the internet, we reach millions at a time. So when we have the internet, we must take every single advantage of it and try to work things in our favor. So I was seen as the very first cyber activist in Togo. Internet was my office. Internet was my territory. And I kept saying that if they are terrorizing us on the ground, we must terrorize them on the internet, to the point that they realize that they have no control of the internet space.
So what happened with that scheme to publish all the numbers and contacts of the MPs and recording the conversations?
Thousands of people stormed them with calls. They couldn't sleep anymore. They organized an extraordinary session at the parliament to talk about it. And the majority leader, when I called him, he told me that, well, you don't have the right to ask me those questions. I don't owe you any response. So the thing is,
His remark was even a little sharper than that. He called you stupid and foolish.
And he called me, he called me crazy, stupid, foolish. He called me all sort of names. But actually, I'm used to those kind of compliments.
You put that conversation online. What happened then?
The conversation went viral. People shared it on WhatsApp, on YouTube, on Facebook. Thousands of people started calling them. It was the very first time in the history of our country that citizens had the opportunity to ask questions to members of parliament and hold them accountable. It made citizens realize that they too had an ability, they had a resource that the government could not necessarily control, and more people got involved through social activism online, because it is safer. They don't necessarily have to see you, and they don't necessarily have to know who you are behind your keyboard or your cell phone.
Togo is a small country sandwiched there between Ghana and Benin. If you look at a map of Africa, it almost disappears. It kind of flies under the radar. If Togo were better known, how much easier would your work be?
It will be so much easier, because even though hundreds of people get killed by this regime, not even a single time in the history of our country was a military official or a government official tried or arrested to respond to those crimes. So they feel galvanized and empowered by that impunity, which is why we are trying to raise as much awareness on the situation as possible, to make them more vulnerable and to make it easier for us to end dictatorship in our country.
Togolese activist Farida Neburema, she's speaking at the Human Rights Foundation's Oslo Freedom Forum next week. Thank you very much for being with us, Farida.
Thank you for having me, Marco.
The government of Bashar al-Assad is gearing up to attack the last major territory under rebel control in Syria. Together with its Russian and Iranian allies, the Syrian regime has moved large forces toward the province of Idlib. A local aid worker there, who would only give his name as Osama, says people will have no refuge from the bombing.
People here in Idlib are really worried about what could happen next. You can feel that fear in all eyes.
Osama says his main worry is his young family.
For me, I had my first baby 8 months ago. Her name is Baylasan. I keep thinking every day and all the day about her, about how to protect her. What should I do to protect her? Should I flee? Should I stay here? This is really a conflict that's taking place every day inside me.
Idlib is the last place where survivors of government attacks in other parts of the country have been able to go until now. Osama says he and the others living in Idlib don't have any other place to go to escape the violence, and they don't expect they'll get any help from the outside world.
So no one in or out. International community will leave Idlib to all the civilians, 3.5 million civilians here, to face their destiny alone, which could be the worst massacre in this world.
The United Nations says almost 3 million people in Idlib are at risk. The UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres gave this warning at the Security Council today.
It is absolutely essential to avoid a full-scale battle in Idlib. This would unleash a humanitarian nightmare, unlike any seen in the blood-soaked Syrian conflict.
So far, peace talks between the government and the rebels have failed, so now Assad's regime appears ready to try to end the war by force of arms. He died, oddly, on 9/11. Rachid Taha, an Algerian-born singer who found fame in France. I say oddly because one of the first times I interviewed Taha was in early 2003, a year and a half after 9/11. I went to Paris to speak with musicians about how the post-9/11 world had affected them and their outlook on life and art. Listen to this moment from my 2003 profile of him. I think I had a cold at the time.
When I hear George W. Bush and when I hear Osama bin Laden, says Rachid Taha, I hear two Bedouin nomads. The only difference, he says, is that one of them is from the desert of Texas and drives an SUV, and the other is from the desert of Saudi Arabia and rides a dromedary. Taha says Bush and bin Laden come from similar well-heeled backgrounds, and both, he says, use a similar fundamentalist rhetoric.
It was acerbic comments like that that turned Rachid Taha into a punk idol for many young French of dual identity, especially the young ones with roots in North Africa. French Algerians, Tunisians, Moroccans, they all heard themselves represented in his songs, like the 1990 hit Barbès, which name-checked the prominent Arab neighborhood in Paris. There's never, ever any problems in Barbès, sang Rachid Taha. He gave glory to Barbès the way rappers gave glory to the South Bronx. I met him again in Paris in 2006. People had just been rioting in the Paris suburbs, cars were being set on fire, and there was a state of emergency. Rachid Taha still had his punk attitude.
Ah oui, après avoir brûlé 100 voitures, je suis crevé, toi.
Wow, after burning 100 cars, I'm exhausted, he joked. Taha couldn't help himself after so many journalists had descended on the French capital to witness the violence. But the situation wasn't funny, and as he told me, the discrimination against Arabs and Africans, people of color in France, that had been happening since he arrived from Algeria as a boy with his parents. They had landed in Lyon and lived in the same kind of apartment block where those riots would break out years later. At first, he said, his family was glad to be in France. Taha said they felt at home. The rents were cheap. They had hot water, a bathtub, in a bathroom, a kitchen, and everyone had their own bedroom. It was great.
La cuisine, etc. On avait chacun sa chambre. C'est formidable.
That was back when there was a socialist government in France, but as Taha's music career was taking off, politics took a turn to the right. First Jacques Chirac, then Nicolas Sarkozy. Taha found himself thinking more about what it meant to be a person of color in his adoptive country. He called his band Carte de Séjour. I guess the best translation would be Green Card. One of their early hits in the 1980s was this tune, Douce France, or Sweet France. French legend Charles Trenet had made it a patriotic classic in the 1940s. Rachid Taha flipped it on its head, satirizing the entire political situation in France with Arabic microtones.
Douce France, chérie de mon enfance, bercée de tant d'insouciance.
When the riots happened in Paris nearly 20 years later, the situation had only worsened for people of color. Rachid Taha reflected on that.
On vit dans une espèce d'apartheid qui ne veut pas dire son nom. Et donc si vous avez un nom...
We live in a sort of apartheid, Taha told me in 2006. If you have a name that sounds Muslim or Arab, you're almost certain not to get a job or find a house. So it's a perpetual thing.
Avoir de logement, etc. Donc c'est perpétuel.
Some things have changed in France, much has not. As for the late Rachid Taha, I'm guessing one thing he left me that didn't change in his mind was this belief.
Il faut pas être fataliste, c'est pour ça que moi je trouve qu'il y a pas assez.
I don't want to be fatalistic, Taha said, but what we need is the fight to happen on a daily basis. I think Rachid Taha would be happy with that as an epitaph.
rabat për sëmë të rëvinë.
Rashid Taha died in Paris yesterday at the age of 59. His family said he had a heart attack. Rashid Taha's treatment of the Clash classic Rock the Casbah. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios here at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for listening.
PRI, Public Radio International.